So welcome to you, and a silent welcome to everybody who will be joining us. And as I mute the call, we will no longer be able to hear each other joining us. But at certain moments, I will unmute us, and then we can speak and share and ask questions. So it's really an enormous pleasure and a big deal, I just want to tell you, to welcome you to this class on What is My Dharma. It's one of the great topics, one of the sacred topics that all of us contemplate or must contemplate or should contemplate or have contemplated. And for me, it's one that's been deeply present all through my life. It's somehow the question of what is my dharma on every level has seemed to engage me at many crucial points. And what I've found is that as I contemplate it, as I consider dharma from my own personal point of view and also from the point of view of the way dharma plays out in the world, what I've come to understand is that it's so fluid, so ever-changing, and yet so completely stable that to contemplate dharma, to ask ourselves moment to moment, what is my dharma, is actually a way that we can at any moment put ourselves in alignment with the cosmos. In the old traditions, there's a beautiful image, the image of the world tree, whose branches run to the heavens and whose trunk runs down into the center of the earth, and the world tree is actually another image. That image of the world tree is from the Western European traditions, and the image that comes from the Indian and Tibetan traditions is the image of the world mountain, which similarly connects all the worlds, connects heaven with the deepest core of the earth. And the nature of the world tree and the world mountain is that it indicates the one kind of pillar-like principle that runs through everything that exists, that literally at every moment, in any moment, connects heaven with earth, which connects the divine with the human, that connects all the different layers and levels of the cosmos with each other. And this world tree, this world mountain, is another name for the principle of dharma, the principle that actually holds the DNA, if you will, for the full alignment of human beings with the core of the cosmos. You know, a great sage in India said that the three major questions of life, or certainly for a person who's living a spiritual life, are who am I, why am I here, and what am I supposed to do? And like all the very greatest questions, these can be applied on pretty much any level that you need to use them. So you can ask, who am I, to determine who you are in relationship to, or who you are as an individual person, in which case your answer could be anything from, you know, from I'm John to I'm an architect to I'm an extrovert, through I'm the boss or I'm an employee. So the question, who am I, can be used to describe your role in life. You can also, of course, ask the question in order to turn into the most universal level of yourself, the level where there are no words, and to what we could call the intermediate level, which is to say, when you ask, who am I, you might also be asking, you know, what's my deepest nature? What's my, you know, who am I as a soul, as a unique individual soul? And in the same way, the question, why am I here, could be asked to determine your purpose for being at a meeting or a party or in a relationship. It can also be used as a question about why you were born at this time or in this family, how you found yourself in this particular life situation. And of course, it can be asked on the ultimate level as, what's the purpose of my being on this earth? And the question, what am I supposed to do, is of course related to our actions and our choices. What do I do in this situation? What's the correct choice at this point in my life? But it also asks the larger question, what am I supposed to do with my life? What's the purpose of my existence? What's, shall we say, the source code, the essential inner program of my soul at this time? You know, the source code is the code inside the computer, which determines how a program works. And the question, what am I supposed to do, is one of the questions that plugs us in to our own source code, our own inner program. So for all of us, the question, what is my dharma, or what am I supposed to do, is related both to our choices moment to moment and to our overall life purpose. And of course, in order to make wise choices moment to moment, we really do need a sense of our overall purpose, of what the late Jungian psychologist James Hillman called the soul's code, with a very beautiful and telling phrase, and what the great Indian tradition that culminated in the Bhagavad Gita called the called swadharma. Swa means your own. And dharma means, well, we're going to find out what dharma means. So let's begin now by chanting the introductory mantras, which we chant with Krishna Das. And those of you who need them, you'll want to have your paper in front of you, the paper with the mantras. And then when we complete the mantras, we're going to offer our practice, offer our exploration. So find yourself a comfortable posture, an upright posture. And use the breath which is the great power that connects our body to our spirit and our spirit to the cosmos. Use the breath to align your posture. So as you inhale, you can feel the base of your posture becoming heavy and grounded. And as you exhale, you can feel the way the spinal column elongates vertebra by vertebra. The breath making space between each vertebrae is spinal column elongates upward towards the ceiling, up through the crown of the head. And again, breathing in, feel yourself grounding, exhaling. Allow the exhalation to make space between each vertebrae. And with the next inhalation, let the shoulder blades release onto the back. And with the exhalation, allow the chest to lift and open. And bring your awareness now into the heart. And see if with the inhalation you can imagine that in the space inside your chest, the space behind the breastbone, there's a golden almond-shaped flame. And at this moment, some of you may be able to visualize the flame. Some of you may simply have a sense of its presence, a feeling of its presence. And this flame is the flame of the soul. It's the flame of our swadharma, the flame of our life's purpose that burns in the heart, that flames and blazes in the heart. So as we chant the introductory mantras, which, as many of you know, invoke the presence of the inner teacher, the inner lord of Dharma, the inner knower of truth, the one who is luminous, peaceful, stainless, whose nature is pure beingness, pure intelligence, and natural, innate joyfulness. That as we invoke this presence through the mantras, feel that you're invoking the presence of that flame in the heart. Through the power of our practice, we ask that all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. We ask that all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. We ask that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We ask that all beings be free of hatred, grasping, and dullness. And we ask that we know the equality of all that lives. Now allowing the breath to flow in and out very naturally, bringing your awareness into the heart, bringing your awareness towards that subtle flame, that delicate golden flame. And as the breath flows in, allow it to flow in with the thought, I am. Allowing that fundamental recognition of your beingness to drop into the flame, to be be offered to the flame. And with the exhalation, see if you can feel the sense of subtle light and warmth in your chest. Sense of the inner flame glowing. So the breath flows in with the thought, I am. The breath flows out, so it flows through the heart with a sense of the inner flame glowing and radiating. And with the breath, you really allow this process to occur. Allow the thought, I am, and the subtle power in the breath to touch your sense of the flame present in the heart. And allow the exhalation to reveal how this inner flame literally radiates like the light of truth, the light of love, throughout your heart. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. The word Swadharma, as it's used in the Bhagavad Gita, means your own duty, your own path, or your own natural way of expressing the cosmic law within yourself. And in the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at Swadharma from several perspectives, as purpose, as our purpose, as our ethical compass, and also as our unique inner path. So we'll look at Dharma as it applies to our relationship with ourselves, our relationship to others, and our relationship to the world. When I first read the Bhagavad Gita, I was in my late 20s, and I was just beginning on the spiritual path, much later than many of you. And I was given Juan Mascaro's translation of the Bhagavad Gita, and I was reading it with a strange sense of compulsion. There was something about it that compelled me, as has been true for many, many people through the ages. There's something about the Bhagavad Gita which literally grabs you and, you know, gives you the feeling that what you're being shown is the essence of the spiritual journey. And of course, you probably remember the situation. The warrior prince Arjuna, at the very beginning of a war that's the culmination of years and years of preparation, a war that has been called the great war of dharma, a war that pits him against his cousins, pits him and his brothers against their cousins, and along with their cousins, many of the elders and teachers of their clan, of their country, of their nation. And the Gita, which is part of a great text on Dharma called the Mahabharata, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the course. At the beginning of this battle, Arjuna asks Krishna, who is acting as his charioteer, to draw his chariot up facing the army and begs Krishna to tell him what to do because he's lost his heart for the fight. And, of course, Krishna's response touches on every essential aspect of spiritual life, from the nature of the self to how to meditate to what to expect when we die. But the key lines, the key instruction, which is actually inspires the whole rest of the text, and the ones that struck me at that time in my life especially, were these. Krishna says to Arjuna, you are by nature a warrior. Your swadharma, your personal duty, your personal path is to fight. Therefore, stand up and do battle. Better your own dharma badly performed than the dharma of another done perfectly. Better your own dharma badly performed than the dharma of another done perfectly. And if you remember what it feels like to first read these lines, at least this is how it felt to me, it's almost impossible to read that sentence without asking yourself the question, what's my dharma? And along with it, how do I know that I'm doing my dharma, that I'm following my own path? And here's the big question. If it's better to do your own dharma, to follow your own path than another person's, even if you screw up your own dharma, then how can I know that I'm not in the wrong dharma, that I'm not on the wrong path? And, you know, for me at that time, I really felt as though I'd found words for a question that I'd been trying to formulate my whole life. It was actually the question that I felt if I could just answer this question, I would have the whole thing solved, the whole thing, the whole, you know, great confusing question of, you know, what am I supposed to do with my life would be resolved. And, you know, the questions that arose at that moment were, where I made my living as a writer, but I had all sorts of hesitancies and insecurities about it. So was writing my dharma? Or did the fact that I was ambivalent about it mean that it wasn't? You know, I'd just begun serious spiritual practice. Was that my swadharma? And then what sort of spiritual practice should I be doing? What was the right spiritual path for me? And then, you know, there were so many other questions. I mean, for instance, in relationship, I was attracted to the idea of intimacy, but I felt trapped in a conventional partnership. So what did this mean about my dharma? Did it mean I was choosing the wrong partner? Was intimate relationship a challenge I was supposed to overcome? Or maybe my path was not supposed to be in ordinary relationship. So the real deep question was, is there really, as Krishna's words seem to imply, a blueprint for right action, perhaps lodged in my DNA, you know, that which is the way I've come to think of it, that could provide my own personal path to a good life? So was this really the clue to the question that had confused me for most of my life? And the issue of what is my dharma is much more complicated now than it was in the pre-modern times in which the Bhagavad Gita was written, because in that era, which was, you know, an era of deep tradition in which people were embedded, very much embedded in their family, in their clan, in their social position. The society of which Arjuna and Krishna were a part simply took it for granted that your dharma was the place in the world that you'd been born to, along with your skills and your ethical capacities. But you know, the nature of action was in a certain sense fixed. The nature of the idea that Krishna tells Arjuna later on in the text is that the family that you're born into, the caste that you're born into, is actually determined by your nature, by your inner nature. So you know, in a world in which tradition restricts us to certain professions according to how we were born, then our choices in terms of dharma really are choices about the attitude with which we'll carry out those already set duties, and you know, the ethics with which we'll perform them. But of course, in our day, you know, especially in such an intensely individualistic society that we live in, and with all the dignities of modernity, as well as its unique difficulties, the question of dharma is often confused by the incredible wealth of choices that we have. You know, in those days, you did not get married. A man did not follow his father's profession. A woman did not leave the home. You know, their children did not disobey their parents. The laws of dharma were very fixed. So the understanding about swadharma was, in a certain sense, easier to determine than it is today. But then again, as the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata tell us, it wasn't really that easy to determine. The one thing that comes very clear in these lines, in these verses, is that there actually is such a thing as a personal path, a personal blueprint for our life, and that unless we're in touch with it, we're actually out of touch with our real source of strength and guidance. When we're inside our dharma, as Krishna will go on to explain to Arjuna, spiritual growth happens naturally. When we're inside our dharma, spiritual growth happens naturally. The path unfolds itself naturally, not without struggle, but any form of growth involves some struggle, some challenge. But when we're not inside our dharma, when we're out of touch with our dharma, we feel stuck, stymied in our work and our relationships and our inner life, in whatever area of our life our dharma has become confused. So what exactly does it mean to be in touch with our dharma? And of course, that brings us to the question of how we define dharma, how we use the word dharma. And this is, again, it's part of what makes the concept of dharma so rich, because like the word karma, the word dharma has several different allied but different meanings. So, for example, my friend Gabriel, who's someone who's been very fortunate in finding a complete alliance between his work and his spiritual path, he believes fully that his dharma is to reveal to people that spiritual life is not possible, that a true spiritual life is not possible unless you're following a vegan diet. My friend, you know, this is a person who's very, very sure, very clear about his dharma. I have another friend, actually a student, who a couple of years ago found herself in what I would call a classic crisis of dharma. She was working in a village in Africa, doing development work for an NGO. It was the work that she felt she'd been born for, what she felt was profoundly beneficial despite the frustrations. And then she got pregnant. She had a child. The child had certain developmental issues. And then she faced the question of whether she should give up her incredibly important and useful work, the dharma, the professional dharma that she felt she'd been born for, or whether the dharma of finding a care for her child trumped her professional dharma. Of course, as most parents would, she chose the child. But in the weeks before she became comfortable with that decision, she literally experienced herself being pulled apart between two apparently conflicting dharmas. Another friend of mine, Rob, a couple of years ago had a brief affair with a coworker. He's married, and the affair didn't last very long. He eventually ended it. He felt the dharma conflict was as to whether or not he should tell his wife about it, because he and his wife had always told each other everything. They'd made a pact to tell each other everything. But the affair was over. He knew that telling his wife about it would hurt her and would probably cause a lot of issues in the marriage. And so the question was, what was his dharma? Was it the greater dharma to tell the truth, to do full disclosure, or was it a higher dharma to protect his wife from being hurt and also protect the smooth texture of his marriage? So for Rob, the question of dharma was really the question of what was the ethical thing to do in that situation. So to him, the word dharmic, which he used as he talked to me about it, was really a synonym for ethics. So what we're looking at here is a couple of definitions of dharma. That one of them is dharma as purpose. The other is dharma as obligation, different, sometimes conflicting obligations, duties. For example, in Linda's case, the duty to her professional world versus the duty to her child. And finally, we have the issue of dharma as ethics. And of course, the issue of dharma as ethics is so deeply at question in our modern world, especially in our contemporary world, especially in this country, as anyone who's been following the Occupy Wall Street protests will know, that there is enormous concern in this country about the ethics of the financial industry and rightness and justice, dharma as it applies to our economic life. So the question of dharma as ethics is a very big deal that many, many people in our world are struggling with, and which many, many people are basically disregarding. So and finally, the fourth meaning of the word dharma is as the spiritual path itself. Buddhists particularly use dharma as a synonym for the spiritual journey, actually as a synonym for Buddhism, for the Buddhist path. So, and if all these people are using the word correctly, and they are, then your dharma could be your personal life path, your calling, your purpose. Your dharma could be the correct action in a moment of decision, the moral or ethical good in a situation. And for many of us, this question of what's the right thing to do is a crucial and recurring question of dharma, or it can also mean the spiritual path itself. But what all these definitions and meanings of the word dharma have in common is that each one of them, each meaning of dharma, implies the deep etymological derivation of the word. The root of the word dharma is dra, which means to support or uphold, and also to nourish. We were talking about the world tree and the world mountain. These embody the quality of dharma as that which upholds and that which nourishes. Dharma is so called, says the Mahabharata, because of its capacity for sustaining the world. And another great text of the Indian tradition, the Manusmriti, which is literally the book of the law codes of classical Indian society, ancient Indian society, says when Dharma is upheld, Dharma upholds you. When Dharma is not upheld, when Dharma is violated, Dharma destroys you. And this, of course, is something that we see all the time in our world. We read about it in the newspaper. So, and this concept of that there's a law in the cosmos, there's reason in the cosmos, there's such a thing as right action, exists in all the traditions. It's called God's law in the Abrahamic traditions. It's called the way or the Tao in Taoism. In Confucianism, it's called Li, correct action. The Romans called it virtue, goodness. And the Greeks had a beautiful word for it, which I think I may not be pronouncing correctly, but the way I believe it's pronounced is arete, which means noble action. It really, the noble excellence. It's the path of utter clarity in all your doings, all your relationships. So, but the, you know, the crux, the core of Dharma is the idea of nourishment. And one way that, to discover whether you're following your Dharma might be to ask yourself whether the universe is supporting you in what you're doing or in the decision that you're making, or whether your actions and your way of life help you feel connected to universal truth. So when this, you know, when the sage said, when Dharma is protected, it protects you, he really meant that something in the very fabric of life, something in the very essence of life, will create some sort of natural order or pattern in the chaos, in the apparent chaos of existence. And if you can find that thread, that pattern, that order, it will actually lead you. It will guide you in all your choices. And so, you know, and we call this Dharma. We call it truth. We call it, in devotional traditions, we might call it God's will. In contemporary evolutionary spirituality, we call it the evolutionary imperative. That force, like gravity, tends to move the world towards a state of harmony that the Greeks called the good. And, of course, it may move crab-like, one step forward, two steps back. But somehow, at least this is how the Indian tradition holds it, somehow, at the end of every cycle, when push comes to shove, Dharma prevails. So, in the largest sense of the word, Dharma is the very root of the sustaining force of the world. It's the divine coherence of the universe. It's the order that runs through everything, through the natural world, and which also runs through our human nature. So, you know, when we say that the seasons change, that when you heat water, it turns to gas, and when you cool it, it turns to ice, when you look at the way the planets move, at the way the solar system functions, at the fact that apple seeds grow into apple trees, that liver cells grow into a liver, that, you know, when you put a stem cell into skin, it will grow as skin. In other words, there's an innate Dharma. There's a kind of a code, which, of course, we've now discovered biologically as the DNA in living things. But, you know, which is actually the larger DNA, the basic DNA, the hologram, in which the greater wholeness of the cosmos is actually embedded in the cell of the individual. And in which each organism has its own uniqueness, its own unique part of the pattern, yet also participates in the larger organism. You know, there's a famous statement by Albert Einstein, which most of us have heard, or maybe we have it pasted on our homepage or on our refrigerator. It's a beautiful secular humanist statement about oneness. He says, a human being is part of a whole called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, the human being, this is Einstein talking, he experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings as somehow separated from the rest, And this is a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. You know that if you're familiar with the findings of deep neurophysiology, you know that that the experience of being truly separate of a universe outside ourselves is actually the result of our brain patterning. It is a kind of optical delusion, although a very useful one. And Einstein goes on to say this delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few people nearest us. And he goes on to say that our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion until it embraces all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. You know, and this is, of course, the expression of one of the fundamental laws of Dharma, which is expressed in the Golden Rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But, you know, which actually arises from our sense of connection to the wholeness. In other words, our recognition that we are inextricably a part of the whole. So in one sense, the understanding of Dharma is understanding our wholeness, recognizing that there's just one law, one intelligence, one life force moving through the universe that is indeed a universe rather than a multiverse. But the fact is that while we are a part of the whole, we're also a unique part of the whole. And the way we find our Swadharma is to find the place where our separate uniqueness expresses the thread of the universal force. So in other words, it's not that we find our Dharma by merging ourselves into the wholeness. We find our Dharma, we connect to our Swadharma, and also to the cosmic purpose by recognizing our own uniqueness, our own unique part in the, you know, in what the Jewish mystical traditions calls the puzzle, you know, our unique part of the puzzle, our unique little jigsaw piece in the puzzle. So, and it's actually an incredible seesaw, because the key to Dharma is not to forget your individuality, but also not to assert your individuality at the expense of the wholeness. In other words, it's to find your true unique path, your unique way of expressing the Dharma, of expressing the truth of who we are, of who and what we are. So we're going to again turn in, bring our awareness to the breath. Have a sense of this subtle inner flame in the heart. And this time we're going to perform a practice that is sometimes called the breath of the soul. And it's really a practice for harmonizing the inside and the outside. So you can breathe in with the feeling that you're breathing in the entire sphere in front of you. With the exhalation, you breathe it out. Inhaling, you feel that you breathe in the whole area behind you. And with the exhalation, you breathe it back out. Inhaling, feel yourself breathing in the sphere to your right. And with the exhalation, breathe it out. Exhaling, inhale the whole sphere, the area to the left of you. And exhaling, breathe it out. Inhale, breathing in the whole sphere above you. And exhale, breathing it out. Inhale, breathing in the sphere below you. And exhale, breathing it out. Now with the inhalation, have the feeling that you're bringing in the spheres on all sides of you and above and below. And exhale, breathing them back out. Having the sense that you harmonize your inner body with the atmosphere. And in this way, you're aligning your own inner energy with the energy of the wholeness. The energy of the atmosphere. You're bringing the outside to the inside and the inside to the outside. So, Swadharma, I'll give you a moment to bring your awareness back into waking consciousness. Recognizing that as perhaps this meditation, which we'll be continuing during the week, has given you some sense of the actual resonance, the harmony, between your what you consider as being the energy inside your body and the energy around your body. This is really a meditation for opening up to the connection, the subtle connection between yourself and the realms around you, the realms that are bound by what we could call the higher law, the cosmic law, the law that the force of life that runs through us all. So this meditation actually aligns our inner universe with the outer universe. And Swadharma is actually the micro-patterning, the inner imperative that aligns our individual sense of ourselves with the greater consciousness as the greater consciousness evolves towards its highest possible expression. So to follow your own dharma is actually to link yourself to the evolutionary force of consciousness, to the unfolding pattern of dharmic rightness, of dharmic growth, of growth into the highest expression of what it is to be a human being. Swadharma is linked with the idea of calling or vocation, but it isn't just your work. But so to follow your swadharma is to follow the thread of guidance that literally calls you to express your being in unique ways. And since our calling, in a very beautiful phrase, is the instrument we play in the symphony of life, when we don't express it, we're actually depriving the universe of the very thing that we were meant to contribute. You know, and of course, in a team and in the world of work, if each of us doesn't carry out our agreements, if each of us doesn't do our part, then the social fabric falls apart. But this is also true in a mystical way. So it's not just that our dharma is to keep our agreements in the, you know, in our family life, in our work life, in our friendships. Our dharma is to keep our agreements with our own soul, to keep the agreement that we made in the deepest part of ourselves with the universe to be who we are, to carry out our own personal path. There's a very beautiful saying by a 19th century Hasidic rabbi named Zusia, who on his deathbed said, "God won't chastise me for not being Moses. He'll chastise me for not being Zusia." You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful expression of what the deepest truth of Swadharma is. We are called to be ourselves, our highest selves. And for each of us, the core of Swadharma is somehow bound up with our willingness to be ourselves, with our willingness to be what we really are. You know, when my guru, Swami Muktananda, was alive, one of the big questions that people used to ask him was this question: what am I supposed to do? And, you know, people would come, this was back in the day when spending time in an ashram in India was something that seemed like an option to a lot of people, and he was a very popular guru, and his ashram was very hospitable. So people would come, and especially people would come at crucial points in their life, you know, like when they were graduating from college, or when they were between jobs, or right before they were about to get married, or right before they were about to get divorced. And they would often come up to him at one of these crucial moments and say, "Tell me what I should do," which he would never do. You know, and they would say, "Should I go to graduate school or get a job in finance? Should I get married and be a householder, or should I be a yogi?" He would always say, "Do what's convenient for you. Do what works for you." And then what he'd say is, "Just understand, your highest dharma is to know yourself, to know your true nature, to know the God living in you as you." And of course, what he was giving us was a spiritual direction. He was saying, you know, the most important dharma is the dharma to know God, to know your highest purpose. But he was also saying something else. Not that occupation, because he didn't believe that occupation is unimportant. He understood the importance of what you do. But what he was pointing out is that to find your dharma, you actually have to go beyond the issue of occupation or vocation. And this is, you know, this is the deep recognition that Krishna is pointing to as we apply his teaching to Arjuna to our own lives. To find your own dharma for a person who hasn't been born into a warrior clan, maybe some of you have been, or born into a family of writers, as I was, you know, in a certain sense, an aspect of my dharma was given to me by my family karma. But for most of us, for all of us, in fact, finding our dharma involves several key things. First of all, learning how to recognize your unique gift, or shall we say, your unique ways, your unique gifts, because most of us have more than one gift, your unique way of expressing the divine through your body and mind by who you are. And this is important. Your unique way of expressing the divine through your body and mind by being who you are, what you are. So being, you know, this idea of being who you are implies that there is actually a blueprint in you, a natural blueprint in you that may be expressed through your gifts, may be expressed through the way you relate to people, but which is actually an innate truth of your being. So recognizing your unique way of expressing the divine through your body and mind. Second, two, recognizing your deepest desire, your deepest intention for yourself. So now this is not the desire that comes from your wounding or from your culture or from what your parents wanted for you. Many of us operate out of what I would call neurotic desire. You know, that is that, you know, like we often say in relationships, someone who keeps getting involved with the wrong partner, is being driven by a desire to perhaps to recreate the relationship with a parent an original relationship that was unsatisfying that they think they can find a way to satisfy with a new partner. So that's what I would call, you know, a neurotic desire or a desire that comes from wounding. Not that it is necessarily useless. In fact, I think that it can be very deeply useful, as you'll see in a story that I'm about to tell. But actually, the desire that's beneath the desire that comes from wounding, the deep desire that actually is the desire of the soul's code, as Hillman very brilliantly says, the desire that contains the imperative of what you need to be and do in order to truly thrive. And the third is to recognize your unique way of serving, the way that your gifts and your heart's desire and your being help the world. I want to give you an example of someone that I've recently been talking to about this. She's, for the last couple of years, this is my friend whom I'll call Jeanette, not her real name. For the last couple of years, she's been trying to figure out what she wants to do with her life. In fact, she's been trying to figure this out ever since I've known her, which is 5 or 6 years. And, you know, she's a lifelong activist, a natural activist. She worked for years in environmental causes and in environmental politics. She has a lot of friends. She's a natural leader. People kind of want to do what she does. She's been married for about 20 years. She's raised a son. And her son recently went away to boarding school. Her mother died. Her marriage felt problematic. And she didn't know what kind of work she should be doing. So nothing about her life felt exactly right. She didn't feel any more certain of her life's purpose. And so she would go around saying, you know, what work should I be doing? Should I stay married or get divorced? Should I stay in the town I live, or should I move to another town? All these questions which come up in our lives over and over and over again. And she finally realized that actually before she could answer any of these relatively external questions, she had to actually relook at her life's purpose. So she began doing a process of self-inquiry in which she wrote the story of her life as if she was writing a myth. And I'm going to ask you guys to do an exercise somewhat like this in the week to come. And as she was writing this story, she started to get in touch with something that she hadn't really thought about in years, but which has been a kind of core for her. It was really the place of her core wounding, and she started to get in touch with early childhood loneliness and sadness. And she realized that even though she's very popular, has lots of friends, is not, you know, has not in her life that often been alone in the sense that many people are alone, that there was this sadness at the core of her, this loneliness at the core of her. And as she began to allow herself to be present with the sadness and the loneliness, which is something that she had never been really willing to do, she'd always kind of run away from it, she realized that there was something rich and authentic about it, that it actually contained a clue for her life. So she asked, how does this sadness connect me to a deeper purpose? She went into her heart, you know, she went, and as she did, and this process took place over, you know, a period of several days, and as she did, an answer came up, and the answer that came up shocked her. And actually, when she told me about it, it shocked me because it was so different from the way I experience her. What she said was, what she heard was, your purpose is to carry the sadness of the world and transform it person by person. So what shocked me about this is that this is a woman that I experience as extremely optimistic, positive, and kind of fun-loving. In other words, not somebody who sort of dwells in sadness. But as she became, as this realization arose in her, she realized that everything truly meaningful she'd done in her life had somehow involved connecting with people whose lives contained sadness in one way or another, and becoming their advocate in some practical way. So even her environmental work had been based on her deep recognition that of the pain of the earth, the sadness of the earth at this time, and her intention to heal it, to transform it. So a few days ago, she called to tell me that what she's been finding since she got in touch with this purpose, which feels quite undramatic and which hasn't, which has not resulted in her being overwhelmed by sadness in any way. But she said that she's actually begun to experience an intuition that rises from this sense of purpose, not in particularly grandiose ways, but as a kind of recognition of where it is that she can intervene because she has a connection. And she told me this story that she'd met a woman on the street in her town, sitting in her car with two children, and she was attracted to the children. She got to talking with them and found that the woman was married to an illegal immigrant from Eastern Europe whose husband's student visa had run out and he'd therefore been deported. And that as a result of the loss of income, they'd lost their house and they were living in a car. The kids were going to a local school. They were spending what money they had on food. And she got into conversation with them and realized that she really had to get the girls a better deal. It was really, she said, about the children, although the woman was great also. And she ended up giving them the money to get a hotel, advising them as to what kind of hotel they should turn to, and arranging for them to get a ticket back to the Eastern European country, which was what, in fact, they wanted to do. And she said she was drawn to help them in a way that felt absolutely unique and right. I mean, it's not that she goes around helping every homeless person on the street, but she was drawn by a sense of dharma to this person. And this is an example of how our wound can show us the dharma code, the source code of our life. So one of the ways we find our way into the recognition of our dharma is by looking into the wound that we feel, the place where we feel wounded. And or into the area where we feel most challenged. You know, often it's in the act of meeting the challenge that we recognize our dharma. One of my friends is a former, one of my former Swami colleagues, he's still a Swami, I'm not, is someone who has he's deaf, he has a very hard time connecting with people on a sort of ordinary level because he doesn't really hear what anybody's saying. But over the years, in working with this challenge, he's perfected a way of actually tuning into people, connecting to people, which goes beyond the words. And from that connection, he's actually able to hear what they're saying. He also happens to be extremely charming and smart. So he often can just connect to people through his charm. But the deeper connection is such that he's one of those people who walks into a room and everybody in the room kind of automatically feels connected by knowing him, by his presence. So, you know, in that sense, that recognition of the wound or the disability or the challenge in life, also, if you work with it, can become the key to the inner soul code. And, you know, there's another piece of it, which is that along with our soul code, you know, our inner dharma, there's also very often an egoic distortion that goes with it. You know, that part of the practice of uncovering our soul's code, I really like that phrase, you know, our dharmic blueprint, is to see the ways in which it's being covered by what we could call the shadow of our innate dharma. And that's also something that we'll be working with later on in the week. I actually would like to ask you now, we're going to do a meditation in a moment, but just in this moment, ask yourself what you experience, what you have experienced at times when you felt that you were expressing your deepest sense of self as a natural beneficial presence. You know, just remember a moment in your life when you actually felt you were acting on purpose in accordance with your dharmic blueprint, with your soul code. Usually we can tell those moments by the felt sense. So when you were being a beneficial presence, either by what you were doing or what you were being, and there should the one of the ways you know that this is that you found a, you know, a kind of a moment, is that in that moment there's no agitation, there's no particular sense of struggle or striving. You just kind of know it because you are it. And it might be a moment with others, it might be a moment at work when you're doing, as it often is for me, when you're doing something creative. It might be a moment of just being present with yourself. So just feel your way into that sense of what it feels like to be on purpose, to be aligned with your purpose. You don't have to know what your purpose is, you just have to tune into that feeling, that felt sense. Notice where it sits in your body. What part of your body gets activated when you feel on purpose? And with that felt sense of tuning into your inner purpose, your soul purpose. You might want to stretch for a moment. Take a drink from your water bottle. But seeing if you can keep that sense of purpose, find yourself a comfortable posture. And again, use the breath, work with the breath, practice with the breath to allow the inhalation to make your sitting bones connect more deeply to your seat. Allow the exhalation to create some space in the spinal column. One way to do this, if you have a little more time, is actually to breathe in to each vertebra, breathing a little puff of air between each vertebra as you walk your attention up the spine, vertebra by vertebra. And notice that as you do this, the breath will naturally uncoil some of the kinks in your spine, and your spinal column will very naturally rise up through the crown. Inhale and feel the shoulder blades releasing onto the back. Exhale and let the chest lift and open. Notice if there are any places in your body where you're holding, where you're clenching. For example, you might want to release your buttocks. Let the chair hold you up. Let the seat, the cushion hold you up. Don't feel like that you have to use your buttocks muscles to hold you up. Just let there be a release there. And sense your belly and allow the belly to become soft. Notice if there's any holding around the shoulders or the jaw. And just notice, bring your attention to those parts of the body. And let your awareness release any holding. Now the breath flows easily in and out. And you allow the breath to bring your attention inward, in towards the center of the heart. And with your awareness inwardly focused, imagine that before you is a doorway. And that your subtle body, your subtle being, the body which you inhabit in dreams, is actually moving through that doorway. Your physical body is seated. But with your body of imagination, you walk through that doorway and you find yourself in a grassy place, standing before a wide avenue surrounded by trees. The trees are tall, ancient, and their leaves form a canopy. And the ground underneath you is mossy, springy, soft. And you imagine yourself walking down that path. The path is welcoming. And even though you don't know what's at the end of it, you feel yourself drawn. And after a moment or two, you find yourself in a grove. And the grove, like the path, has a mossy, earthy floor. It's literally like a room under the sky, like one of those ancient groves of Celtic times. And you see before you an ancient and beautiful tree, an enormous tree with a thick trunk. And you sense that you're in the presence of the world tree, the tree that connects heaven and earth. You sense how deep into the earth the roots go. You sense that the ebullient, luxurious branches flow up into the heavens. And yet you also sense the coziness of the tree. It's majestic. It's cosmic. But it's also completely intimate. And the feeling of standing in front of this tree is one of being welcomed to a very familiar place. And you notice that facing the tree is a stone bench strewn with cushions. So you sit on the bench facing the tree. And with each breath, you tune yourself to the sense of the presence of this tree of Dharma, the world tree, the central pillar that supports the world, the living Dharma. Just allow yourself to draw in the deep, nourishing presence of this embodiment of Dharma, the wisdom tree, the tree of Dharma, the world tree. The thread of cosmic life force. World soul. With each breath, you feel the loving, peaceful, wise presence of the tree. You feel yourself more and more in tune with it. And then you notice that seated under the tree is a being, a human being, but a being irradiated with light, and a being who is somehow rooted in the earth, rooted to the trunk of the tree. And you realize that what you're looking at is your own self. This being has the form of your own body. You're looking at your higher self in embodied form. So, gazing into the literally enlightened form, the radiant form of your embodied higher self, you recognize the self as you. You, free of confusion, free of ambivalence, free of limitation, fully empowered, fully in love with life, fully in love with yourself, fully in love with the world, supported, held, nourished, embodying Dharma, your Dharma. And you recognize that this is you as you're meant to be. This is a vision of your own inner blueprint embodied, made external for the purpose of allowing you to speak to yourself. And just let yourself be present with yourself in this form. You may find it kind of amusing and delightful to be present with this being who's you. You might notice that this being has a little smile. And then you ask him, you ask her, what can you show me or tell me about my own dharmic blueprint? What is the key to my dharma? Show me or tell me. What is my fundamental soul code dharma in this life? What is it that my nature wants to express through me? And you just ask the question. And you allow yourself to open to receive whatever arises in response. This could be words, could be an image, often a feeling, just a pure feeling. Just let yourself receive whatever arises, whatever comes up for you. Feel like you've fallen out of touch with this being and with the transmission, you can tune in and ask the question once again. And by the way, don't think too much about it. Just let yourself receive whatever shows up, whatever the download is at this moment, without expecting it to be one thing or another. And now feel that with your inhalation, you breathe the presence of your higher self, your embodied, empowered, fully dharmically alive self. The embodied form of your inner truth, your Swadharma. Breathe her, breathe him into your body, in through the heart. And feel that this being, this incarnate soul code, Dharma body, merges with your own body. So that now as you sit and follow the breath and feel your own presence, your own energy alive within you, you are breathing and living as the unique embodiment of your true self. You are simply the incarnate presence of God dwelling within you as you. And please write down anything you'd like to write down. We'll be bringing our call tonight to a close. You'll be getting a homework assignment both for meditation and for a contemplation and inquiry about your personal soul code. And in it, you'll I'm going to ask you to spend a few minutes writing and contemplating and just see what arises for you as, let's say, a working soul code. The instructions will explain to you how to do it. So these two practices, the daily meditation practice, which will be on the breath meditation that we did during the class, and also the exercise, the writing contemplation exercise on what you can find from within yourself as the at least preliminary sense of your Swadharma, your personal Swadharma. That's what we'll be doing this week. And the listserv, of course, is open, and the listserv welcomes questions and sharing of experience. I'll answer any questions that you send in, and other people often have interesting things to say about each other's questions. The call will be downloaded and available in the private area of the website tomorrow. Debbie will let you know when that is. And have an exquisite week, an exquisite evening. Thank you for being with us. Many, many blessings and tons of love to you. Namaste.